Hello, everyone. My name is Magdalena, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank everyone who's here today, and I especially want to thank Stan and Harlem. Harlem asked me to speak about two years ago, and we were in a funeral together, and he said, "Are you done doing service?" And then I said, "Yes, after 18 years, nobody wants me around anymore." And Harlem said, "I want you to speak. We want you." So I said, "Yes, thanks." And so because of him, I'm here. And I'm my deepest condolence to the AA community in Seaside. I know what a jewel he was. And I'm sure we will all miss him. Thank you. What it was like, what happened, and how it is today. My home group is the Renton Thursday Night. It's the oldest group in the state of Washington. Yeah, so. What happened back in the days, we didn't have a World Service office, so there was no Al-Anon, and a lot of groups used to send their registrations with Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they talked to Bill, and Bill said, "I have all these registrations. They don't qualify. You know, these are for the families." And so Bill went to his wife Lois and gave her all these registrations. And then Lois told Bill, "I'm 60 years old. I've been homeless most of our lives, and now we finally have a home. And you want me to do what?" So thank God by Lois had the love for the friends and families of alcoholics that she went and talked to her friend Ann B. And they both got together and wrote letters to 87 groups that were registered were wanting to be registered with Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and they wrote a letter saying, "Would you like to be part of Al-Anon family groups and accept the steps and adopt the steps and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And 56 of those groups responded, and my home group is one of them. So we've been here since the beginning, and in June we will be still celebrating 67 years of continuous meeting. So thank you. I am from Mexico, from Ensenada. I am the oldest of six girls. My dad always wanted a boy, and I was born. So he named me after his father. His name was Magdaleno, so he just changed the O to an A, and here I am. You know, my dad and I never got along. My dad is a problem drinker. He's still drinking until this day. My dad is one of those drunks now that he's just standing there and he can hardly walk and he pees on himself. And you know, he was this guy that at one time he was just the meanest guy. When I was a little girl, I always had a problem with him. My dad and I never got along. I remember in the morning my dad used to get up and tell me "larguchona," which it really doesn't mean anything. It's something ugly and long, you know. I've always been tall and thin, and my dad would tell me in the morning, "larguchona, go get me a bottle of tequila." And I remember, you know, going to the liquor store when I was 6, 7, 8 years old and getting a big bottle of tequila. And in my way back, I remember thinking, "My gosh, I can't remember the last time I had milk. All we eat at home is beans and tortillas every single day." And so I would get home and tell my dad, "Well, here's your tequila. And by the way, you know, I haven't had milk in a long time." My dad was a baker at that time, and we didn't even have any bread in the house. So I would tell him, "We don't have any food, and here you're drinking." So my dad used to get really mad at me. He used to put this skinny leather belt and just pull it out really fast and hit me with the belt. Just hit me. And I remember being this skinny little girl, and I would put my arms in front of my face so I could protect my face from not being hit, you know. But I had belt marks all over my legs and my arms, and I would go to school like that. And the kids in school, they really didn't want to play with me. They said, "Gosh, you know, we don't want to play with you. You know, most kids in Mexico are short and chubby. They're cute. I'm tall and skinny, so it was really hard to get, you know, to avoid kids seeing me. And so I wanted to get close to the kids and play with them, but they didn't want to play with me. They're like, no, look at you. You look like a light pole. And then the kids would say, look at you, your dad beat you up again. And then you smell like beans. And I did, because we didn't even have a toothbrush. And so I remember, you know, just staying on the corner looking at kids playing. I had no friends, and it was I just always felt bad. I but you know, I was this great kid that I couldn't see that on myself. I remember I got into yoga at age 6. By age 11, I became vegetarian. I was teaching yoga to adults, and I had a, you know, I was a good kid. I loved sports, but then when I would get home, I would get beat and tell that I was just this horrible kid. And my mom, she just kept having kids. You know, she just kept having kids. She didn't believe, well, back in the day, they used to say that the Pope said that if the women took birth control, they would go to hell. You know, so my mom didn't take any birth control pills. And she just kept having kids. And my dad is about 5'4", 5'5", big belly, big head, really ugly. And my mom is tall and gorgeous. You know, I just think she's just beautiful. And I just couldn't understand what she was doing with this ugly, ugly guy. You know, and so when she would say that, you know, that she didn't want to go to hell, I thought, well, you're already living there, you know, with this ugly guy. It just didn't make sense to me. And every time a child was born, my dad would say, oh, another prostitute, another prostitute. So I grew up thinking that I was this prostitute. And then they never talked about my grandfather. And I said, Mom, how come nobody talks about my grandfather? And then she said, well, because he was crazy. I said, well, what's wrong with him? And she said, well, she said, so the story goes that they didn't know what to do with my grandfather, because Magdaleno, they didn't know what to do with him because he was a drunk, you know. So what they did, they said, she told me that he was crazy and they just didn't know what to do with him. So they built a box in the backyard and they stuck my grandfather in there. And they had a little door like this, you know, where they fed him. So as you know, you can imagine, he probably didn't have much of a social life, and his only friend was my father. So my father started buying alcohol for his father, and they started drinking together when he was about, you know, 8 years old. And by the time my parents met, my father was already a problem drinker. So my father also is this kind of alcoholic that he always had a girlfriend on the side, and I just couldn't understand him being so ugly, you know. But then later on, I learned that alcoholics have, you know, good talkers. So my dad was a good talker. And one day, because he always had a girlfriend on the side, one day he came and told my mom, you know that I'm seeing somebody else. You know that I don't love you. She's much younger than you, and I want you to leave and take your 5 kids with you. And my mom, not knowing what to do, she started looking for work, you know. But she was on her middle 20s, maybe late 20s, with 5 kids and a 6th grade education. So nobody will hire her. But she started looking, but there was no jobs in Mexico. And then she told me, if I go to work in the U.S., can you take care of your sisters? And I say, yeah, Mom, I can take care of my sisters. And so that's when I became my sister's mother. And I wasn't a very good mom. You know, my dad hit me, I hit my sisters, and that's all I knew. And you know, in the fourth step, it says that we make a truly and honest moral inventory of our lives and of ourselves. And I need to say that I didn't know this, but truly looking at myself, I was able to see that not everything was bad in my childhood. I had these wonderful grandparents on my mom's side, you know, They just loved me. They told me every single day, every single time they saw me, they would say, oh, mi negra, which means my black girl, you know? Because in Mexico, you know, the darker you are, the lower class you are. And I was pretty dark, but since I moved to Washington, you know, something happened. I became a color I didn't know I was. So my grandma would make flour tortillas, and then I would remember getting the flour tortilla, putting butter, and just eating the tortilla. And then I would go next room where my grandfather was, and my grandfather, you know, I thought he was just so smart. He had all these books that he read, and the book smelled so good. And then he will, you know, he will tell me places he went to, but while I was sitting on my grandfather's laps, I was helping him clean the seats out of the marijuana, and then I will roll the joints for him, you know, and then my grandpa will light up the joint and say, "Hear me, how you want to take a hit?" And I said, "Oh no, grandpa, that stinks." And then my grandfather was so smart, he would start talking in Japanese and Chinese, you know, but in reality, you know, I think he was just high the whole time, you know. So anyways, I had people that loved me when I was a little girl. My father would also tell me in the morning, you know, "Larguchona, get up and sweep the floor." And I would look at him and I go, "Why? It's a dirt floor." It didn't make sense to me, but it did to him. So anyways, my mom was able to find a job in the U.S., and she came and she was working as a nanny, cleaning houses and babysitting, and then she started sending money. But what happened, I didn't know, see, that alcoholism is a progressive disease, and my dad stopped looking at us like we were his daughters and started spying on me when I was getting undressed, and started touching my sisters in a way a father should never touch his kids. But see, I didn't know that he was just sick. And in our Al-Anon literature does say that sometimes those are the symptoms of that disease. But see, I didn't know, I just thought he was a monster. One day I wrote to my mom and I said, "Mom, this is what's going on here." And then my dad also would not allow me to go to school. He said that women should not go to school. Women should be selling food on the streets. And then he would call me all kinds of names. You know, "You're stupid. You're too dark. You're a prostitute." And I believe everything my dad said. And so my self-esteem was really low. I remember wanting to kill myself when I was a little kid because there was just, it was just not a good place to be, and so my mom said, "If you want to come to live in the U.S., you can come and work with me, but you can't go to school." And I said, "That's okay, Mom. I'm not learning anything. I remember going to school trying to read the books, but the words would just dance. You know, I just could not learn anything, nothing will penetrate in this head. Because when I was reading, I was trying to read, I would be thinking, am I going to get beat today? Will I have something to eat? Do I need to go gather wood so my mom can cook? You know, so nothing. So I stayed back in third grade 3 times. I was just this tall, stupid kid that could not learn anything. And so I told my mom, "That's okay, Mom. I'm not learning anything anyway." So I came to the U.S. like most Mexicans do. I jumped the fence and went to work, you know. And I went to work at a chicken farm. And in this chicken farm, there was rows and rows and rows of chickens. And in every row, there was about a lot of wire boxes. And that's where the chickens were. And under those wire boxes, there was the chicken poop. And so when immigration came to take the illegal Mexicans back to Mexico, you know, some of them will run up the hill and some of us will hide in the chicken poop. You know, so I was one of those that hid in the chicken poop. But when you're sitting in the chicken poop, you know, there's worms, there's bugs, and they just stick to your skin, you know. And the chicken poop is really creamy, you know. So there's no way you're gonna get away from it, you know. So I remember just sitting there waiting, and I just didn't want to get arrested, because if I got arrested, that would mean that I had to go back with a monster, and I didn't want to go back with him. And so I remember when I didn't hear any more noise, I would come out and try to wipe myself off, but I couldn't, because the chicken poop was stuck to me. And I'd be thinking, I'm worth nothing. I'm nothing. I don't even exist in this country. And so one day, sometimes I got arrested, I got deported, and others I did not. When I got deported, when I would get deported, I remember standing on the borderline, you know. And, you know, this is my story, okay? I don't want to offend anybody, but this is my story, and this is what happens to the disease of alcoholism. I know there's a lot of things going on in our beautiful country today, but this is reality of life. And so I remember standing on the border lines and looking at both sides, and if I didn't see any border patrol officers, I would run and run and run to the other side. And if I didn't get arrested, I was disappointed. It's like, oh, they didn't arrest me. You know, so I would go back and do it over again, because I was addicted to excitement. I still am. I love excitement. You know, I found a cure for excitement and recovery, which is service. We just do service. You know, Edwin can tell you, he's been so busy all day. You know, service gets you busy. So, and then we get better, is what we say in Al-Anon. So one day I told my mom, Mom, can I go to school? I don't have any friends, I don't speak the language. And she said, yes, you can, but you can't stop working. I go, I'll go to night school. So I went to night school, and that's where I saw the most gorgeous guy in the universe. There he was, you know, he was tall, thin, beautiful, long hair. And I remember looking at him, and the world stopped. You know, I immediately fell in love with this guy. And he moved like that, you know, he had a... And I just, the world moved with him. But then I looked at myself, you know, and I started playing those old tapes that my dad used to tell me, you're stupid, you should be selling food on the streets, you're too dark, you're too skinny, you're a prostitute. You know, my dad was not there anymore. He was not telling me that. I was sick, you know. Many times we tend to blame the alcoholic for whatever happens, but in reality, I had become sick too, and those tapes had been part of me. In Al-Anon, I learned that when somebody shares something negative about one person, if somebody was to tell me something negative, our literature says that it's only a reflection of how they felt. So my father felt bad, and so that's why he was saying that. Somebody who thinks positive about themselves will not say something negative to somebody. So, but at that time I didn't know. And Al-Anon also says that anything we let go has our claw marks on him. So even though I felt so bad about myself, I was not gonna let this guy go, you know? So one day I would see him go down the hall with a lot of his friends, and I had that one friend, and I remember, as I, you know, I started stalking him. Back then it was called spying, but now it's called stalking, you know. So I started spying on him, and every time he went by, I would throw kisses at him and then push my friend so he would think it was her. But then somehow he found out it was me, you know. And one day I was at the park with this friend, and then there he was with a lot of his friends. This guy was so popular. And he called me over, and after we introduced ourselves, he said, would you like to go to a concert tonight? And I said, gosh, I wonder what that is. And I said, sure. You know, I had never listened to English music, and it was 1975, and Bad Company was playing in San Diego. So he came to pick me up. He had a little Nova, and I got to sit next to him. And I looked in the back seat of the car, and there was a lot of people. They were piled up on top of each other. And I thought, God, I wonder how they fit in there. You know, this is before seatbelt laws and all that. So, but I didn't care. I got to sit next to him. And then he pulled out this 8-track player, put it on the stereo, and this loud music came out. And, oh, I was just so impressed. And then they started smoking marijuana, and I thought, oh my God, you know. I felt the love of my grandfather all over again. And they passed the joint right in front of me, and I said, oh no, thank you, because I don't smoke, right? I've never been high or drunk in my life. So I go, oh no, thank you. But in my head, I thought, you know, I can roll them for you if you need help, you know, because I had years of experience at that time, you know. But it was our first day, so I didn't say anything. We dated for 2 years, and during these 2 years, he tried to kill me a couple of times because he was high on acid. And I thought, ah, oh, poor guy, you know. His mom abandoned him in Mexico when he was a little boy. He grew up on the streets. But when we get married, I'm just going to love him enough that he's going to stop using drugs, you know, and alcohol. And I really thought he will. I really thought. You know, I also thought, okay, when we get married, we're going to live in a nice area in Rancho Bernardo, which is higher class neighborhood in San Diego. And then we're going to play tennis in the weekends. And then we're going to have two nice lowriders park outside, you know. But of course, none of that happened. So I told him, I'm pregnant, and I said, I'm a strong woman, and you don't need to marry me. And he said, you're crazy, we're getting married. So we got married, and as I was walking down the aisle, I'm thinking, am I really a prostitute? You know, all those tapes. And we had this beautiful little girl. She was just so gorgeous. You know, she was a plumpy little girl. She was light complexion. She looked just like her dad. And we named her Mirabella, which means look at the beauty. And I remember looking at this beautiful little girl, and I told her, I love you so much. You know, you're part of two loves, you know, two people that really love each other, and you're a miracle. And I remember looking at her and saying, I love you so much. I'm never gonna let anyone hurt you. I'm just gonna love you and protect you, and nobody's gonna hurt you like I've been hurt. But see, I didn't know that alcoholism is a progressive disease, and living with an alcoholic, we become sick too. And all my attention was on what the alcoholic was doing, not doing, and how to prevent him from doing whatever he was doing. By this time, my sisters had moved to the States. Some of them were using drugs, some of them got married, were being beat up by their husbands, some of them had joined gangs, and it was just a mess. Everything was a mess, but I just, you know, I couldn't find my husband. I remember calling his mom, his friends, you know, hospitals, jail, everywhere. He was never home. He was just not home, and I remember thinking, how stupid can you be, you know? Why would you think that somebody like him will ever look at you, you know? And then I would start saying all those tapes, you know? And so I would take my daughter to my sister so they could take care of him so I could, you know, have enough time to go look for him. And it just got really bad. And so I thought, okay, my husband started shoplifting because he was using heroin. I started shoplifting with him because he needed a supportive wife, you know. I know. Then I thought, okay, that's not working. Then he will get home, and I remember waiting for him, wearing something sexy, you know, and just waiting for him. By 2, 3, 4 in the morning, I was no longer feeling sexy. So I would go to the kitchen door, grab a knife, and just wait for him, you know? And then when he would walk into the door, you know, I just wanted to kill him. And my daughter would come out crying and just like, Mom, Mom. And I would grab my daughter and just throw her in the room. Then we always lived in bad neighborhoods. And the neighbors would come upstairs and say, Magdalena, leave him alone. And then I would go be with a knife like this. I go, if you don't leave, I'm going to kill you too. So the guys would just leave, you know. They're like, oh, we're friends, but not that good of a friend, you know. So I thought, okay, if I have a child, if I have a boy, then he really is going to stop drinking. So I had a boy, and I made that same promise to my son, and I named him after Carlos. And I thought, okay, now he's really going to stop drinking because I named a child after him. You know, it makes sense to me, but of course did not. You know, he continued. Things got worse really fast. My grandfather and my husband were now getting high together. My mom and she had a boyfriend. She had another girl. And they were both selling heroin to my husband. My sisters had joined, you know, dangerous gangs, and I just didn't know what to do. You know, I thought, well, if I drink with him, you know, if I use heroin like him, you know, maybe he'll look at me how stupid I look, and then he'll stop. He'll realize that how bad he looks, and then he'll stop. And then I thought, in our literature, our 12 by 12 talks about that. Many of us join the alcoholic, we drink with the alcoholic, so the person, there'll be less alcohol for them. And so there's never enough, right? So anyways, I thought about doing that, but then I thought, who's gonna take care of the kids if I start using heroin? So I never did anything. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. Everything was just ugly, and I stopped having friends. I stopped laughing. I stopped taking care of myself, and I just was just watching and seeing what the alcoholic was doing. So one day, finally, I had my two kids, and one day I got in the car, and I remember as a child going to church because my mom told me I needed to go to church. And I remember going to church and I would confess my sins. You know, I hit my sister to the priest, and then the priest would say, well, go over there and pray. And so I knew that church was not a place for me. I just could not find any relief there. And I thought, well, if I go to a counselor, maybe the counselor can help me. But, you know, people like me didn't go to the counselors. I thought people that went to counselors were those who had boogers coming out of their nose, saliva. And I looked at myself in the mirror, and there was no liquids coming out of my face, so I didn't even belong there. So one day, I got in the car, and I just thought, this is it. I can't go on anymore. This is it. There was just nowhere to go. And so I got in my car, and I put my kids in the back seat of the car, and I started driving, and I just wanted to die. And I was going 100 miles an hour. And see, I love my kids. I love my kids. And I was hitting them. I hated myself for doing that. I was not feeding my kids. I was not taking care of them. I had broken the promise that I had made to them. And I just couldn't stop myself. And so I thought, okay, if my kids continue in this life, you know, they're going to grow up and become gang members. They're going to end up in prison. They're going to be heroin addicts. I just didn't want that for them. So I got in the car. I started driving, and I was driving 100 miles an hour, and I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die, you know. But then in that moment, I remember screaming and said, if there's a God up there, please help me stop, because I just want to die. There's nowhere for me to go. And, you know, when we ask God for help, God always listens. He always does. It might take him some time, but he always listens. And so in that moment, God listened to me. He knew my desperation. And few days, few weeks later, my husband went to court, and the judge told him, you either go to treatment or you go to prison. So he said, I'll go to treatment. And that's when I was introduced to Al-Anon. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I sat there, and I was not ready. I, you know, people just looked so nice. They had a sparkle on their eye. They were dressed nice. And I looked at them, and I didn't look like any of them. And they asked me, would you like to share? And then I said, well, I'm not sure if I belong here. I said, see, my husband's not an alcoholic. He's an addict. And so I don't think I belong here. But see, I didn't want to see that my husband was drinking every morning, but I didn't want to see that he was just like my father, because I hated my father. And I also thought that addicts were higher class than alcoholics, you know? And I didn't want to be married to an alcoholic, of course. So I told this lady, yeah, I don't think I belong here. And I had the false pride that many of us do. You know, I'm better than. I'm married to this hard dude with tattoos. You know, my sisters have nice low riders. They're gang members. It's like I had nothing. We were just dying. And so this really nice lady tapped me on the shoulder and said, dear, keep coming back. So I didn't come back for 6 months. Or these 6 months, things continued to get worse. I told Carlos, let's move to Mexico. The problem is your friends. I'm still illegal. I'm crossing the border, you know, illegally every single day. I'm saying that I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm driving 160, 140, I don't know how many miles a day to keep him away from his friends. I decided that he needed a stronger message, so I went into karate classes. And then instead, you know, when he will come home, instead of waiting for him, I thought I had gained some sort of serenity. So when he will come in the house, instead of waiting by the window, I will jump out of bed and go, ha, ha, ha. Try to cut him in little pieces. That didn't work. He continued to drink. And one day, I, you know, after 6 months of doing this, I remember driving. Carlos went to treatment, started using again, and I was driving, and I looked at him and he was passed out. I wasn't sure if he was dead or alive. I didn't care in that moment. Something had finally happened in my head. It's like I woke up of a nightmare, and then I looked in the back seat of the car, and there was these two kids, and my kids were just sitting there. They were super skinny. They had long hair. They had the saddest look on their eyes. You know, my kids were born vegetarians, and I took them to Mexico. There was hardly anything for them to eat. I you know, there's no grass, there's no water, there's nothing over there. My husband did not take him there. I took him there, and in that moment, I remember the promise that I made to those kids. The upholstery of the car had been teared down, and I go, what happened? How did I get here? How did I get here? What happened to the promise that I was going to love him and protect him? And in that moment, the only thing, I had run out of solutions. The only thing that came to my head was keep coming back and first things first, the slogan, first things first. So in that week, I made a decision to let go of Carlos and move back to the States. And Carlos went to prison for a year, I think, and I went back to Al-Anon. And we moved into this apartment complex that there was a lot of people doing drugs, but you know, when you finally have hope in your heart, that's not important. So I remember going to my second Al-Anon meeting, and this time I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. I had the hope from the first day, you know, that I got on the first day. And I remember going to my second Al-Anon meeting and just sitting there. And I went to the meeting. There was no Spanish meetings, and I didn't speak English. I knew a little bit. I could understand more than I could speak. And I remember sitting in that room, and I had this big, heavy jacket. I had holes on my jeans. I had long hair that Carlos used to cut my hair when, because we couldn't afford a hairdresser, so he would cut my hair while he was drunk. And that's how I got to my second Al-Anon meeting. And I remember sitting there just shaking. I was just shaking. I was so cold. You know, when we're cold, I mean, when we're lonely, when you have just lost everything, every faith, everything, I remember my heart being so cold. And I would just sit there, and I was so scared that somebody was going to tell me to leave. But I got to sit there, and nobody said anything. And everything happens for a reason. It was a large group of people in a small room. So when I sat on the couch, two people sat next to me, and I stopped shaking. You know, the first miracle happened. I stopped shaking, and I feel secure. And And in our Al-Anon literature, it says that we come to Al-Anon on our first step, it says that we come looking for relief. I just didn't know what I was looking for, but I just could not go on one more day living the way I had been living. So I heard, get a sponsor, work the steps, keep coming back, read the literature, and stay connected, and do service. So on my second or third meeting, I went up to this man, and I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And I asked Ralph if he wanted to be my sponsor, because every time somebody shared, Ralph would look at that person. And you know, when we live in alcoholic homes, nobody listens to anybody. I remember trying to have a conversation with my sisters or my husband or whoever, but we were not communicating. Our literature says that we speak a different language. So I remember trying to speak, and when they didn't listen, I would get louder and louder and louder. But in Al-Anon, nobody was doing that. Everybody was listening to each other. And so after the meeting, I went up to Ralph and I asked him if he would be my sponsor. And see, I didn't know that Ralph was from England. And Ralph has this strong English accent. I'm from Mexico, I can't speak English. But I approached him. And you know, Al-Anon Declaration says, when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon always be there. And Ralph was there for me. And I went up to him and I said, will you be my sponsor? And Ralph looked at me and he said, we'll give it a try, Magdalena. So Ralph and I started getting together and we started working on step one. I knew I was powerless over, you know, over the situation, and my life had become unmanageable. I was super thin, I had anemia. I was just not taking care of myself. And so we started working on that. On step two, you know, Rob said, Magdalena, just because the alcoholic says you're whatever, you know, how can you believe what somebody who's drunk says? That's insanity. So we started working on that and asking God to return me to sanity. And then I said, God, you know, I don't know if I want a God. I don't trust a God. The God of my understanding, I don't trust. And he said, well, what makes you feel good? I said, when I go to the ocean, because I'm from Ensenada, when I go to the beach, I feel some sort of serenity. I feel joy in my heart. And Ralph said, that's your higher power, you know. But as I progress in life, in my program, I realized that God created the universe, and he created the ocean. So anyways, we started working on the other steps. I got to step three and then step four, and I would tell Ralph, you know, I'm tall, I'm ugly, I'm whatever. And Ralph said, Magdalena, you need to stop criticizing yourself. He said, see that bird up there? And because Ralph and I will meet in a park, and I learned that I could not leave my kids with my alcoholic sisters because my kids were coming home with cigarette burns on their skin. And see, my sisters love my kids. They absolutely love my kids. But it was the disease taking over, and those had taken over, and those people that were around the house. So I learned that I could not trust my alcoholic sisters or whoever with my kids. So I started bringing my kids to the park, and while Ralph and I would work on the steps, my kids would play, and Ralph would say, see that bird up there? And I said, yeah, it was a crow. I said, what do you think of that bird? I go, well, it's beautiful, it's shiny, you know, it's very dark and shiny and dark. And Ralph would say, do you think that bird worries, looks at itself in the mirror and say, you're so dark, your feathers are out of place? Like, no, that bird gets up and goes and does God's will, goes to work, finds food for the kids, and brings it to the kid, you know, to the birds. And we do God's will. I said, and then he said, Magdalena, you are nobody to criticize the children of God, which includes you. So I don't want to hear you calling yourself names anymore. And so I started doing that. And I have always enjoyed exercising. So I remember going for a run. And in the past, I would say, oh, if somebody passed me, I would say, oh, look at you, you're so slow, that guy just passed you. But then, because Rolf told me I couldn't call myself names, I remember going for a run and singing, when somebody passed me, I would sing to myself, pretty woman running down the street. So I started standing taller, looking at people in the eye, and I became a part of you. Because we're all children of God, and God made us equals. He said, Magdalena, don't you think that if we all look alike, this life will be pretty boring? Yeah, I just didn't think about that, you know. And one day I was, my husband got out of prison, okay? Finally. There was no meetings in Spanish, so I started meetings in Spanish. And I thought, my family will come. That's a cure to everybody's problems. But they never came. You know, other people came. There was no Alateen, so I started Alateen meetings. I took my kids to Alateen. They were very active in Alateen. And life was just busy. And then my husband gets out of prison. And I'm like, oh, well, what am I going to do now? You know? And then one day I had learned that, you know, I remember calling Ralph or one of my friends in Allen, and I would say, my kids are crying. I don't know what to do with them. And then my sponsor or my friends would say, well, Magdalena, when you pick up the kids from the daycare, you take them home, you feed them, you take them for a walk, and listen to those kids. Listen what they have to say. And I remember, and he said, don't say anything. And I remember listening to my kids, and my kids loved their father. They knew there was something wrong with him. You know, they just knew he was sick. But what was wrong with me? They just didn't know. You know, I used to take my kids to visit their father in prison, and they knew he was sick. But what was wrong with me? So I would just listen, not say anything. Then I would bring him home, take him, you know, help him with their homework, give him a bath, put him in bed, read something, you know, things that people know what to do. I didn't know. I learned that in Al-Anon. And then they said, and then you put yourself to bed and you read something, because in the pamphlet of Just for Today, it says, just for today, I will read something. I will not be a mental loafer. So I started reading, and I started learning. The words were not dancing anymore. You know, I was learning, and so my husband came home, and he said, if you don't do A, B, and C, I'm going to go out and get drunk. And then I said, well, just make sure you lock the door on your way out, you know, because I had learned. I had learned that there is a power greater than me, and they could take care of our loved ones. So I instead of going to get drunk, he went to an AA meeting, and today he's been sober for 34 years. So. It was 1990, and the world was gathering together in Seattle, the Al-Anon and AA convention. And my husband and I decided to come, and you know what happens when you stop bailing the alcoholic out of jail? There's money, isn't it? There's money. So we were able to buy a home, a trailer, a boat, everything we always wanted, we had, you know, so we were happy. But then we came to Seattle, and we just felt in love with Seattle. It was just so beautiful that, you know, Carlos and I talked about it. It's like, why can't we move to Seattle? It's just beautiful. And Carlos said, well, there's nothing stopping us. Wherever we go, God is. Alcoholics Anonymous is everywhere in Al-Anon. There's family everywhere. And so we went back home, sold everything, and 6 months later, we moved to Seattle. And we moved into this tiny little apartment, but, you know, we didn't care. Because, see, money is good. It's good energy. But we don't let our lives, you know. There's hopes, and God's everywhere. And so anyways, we trusted that everything was going to be okay. So we moved to Seattle. I went to work at a Denny's restaurant. And I worked graveyard. Carlos would work graveyard. Kids went to school. I went to the local intergroup office, and I asked him if they needed any service, anybody to do service, because I said, I know I can't keep it unless I give it away, so I got to get busy. And they said, well, just keep coming back so we can get to know you better. You know, so I kept going back, and they gave me the great honor to be the Alatin coordinator for the Seattle Intergroup office. I had done that in San Diego, so I was just so happy that I was doing service. Kids were in Alatin. Carlos got busy starting Spanish meetings, AA Spanish meetings, and we were just busy. And then one day I remember we started seeing our daughters that she looked a little different, and even though she was speaking everywhere, she spoke in Alaska, different high schools, and she was just an active kid, but then she started coming home with black bags under her eyes and bruises on her arms. It's like, what's going on? And we found out that she was drinking. And I remember saying, you know, to my God of my, the God of my understanding, I remember screaming at God and saying, how dare you give me an alcoholic daughter after all the service work I have done, you know? So I called Ralph and I said, Ralph, my daughter's drinking. And Ralph said, well, Magdalena, you know, I think, he said, perhaps God wants your daughter to learn something. See, God loves alcoholics too. I'm like, oh, he does? No, just kidding. I said, okay. See, he said, it's not all about you, Magdalena. Your daughter needs to learn something. I go, okay. So that's when my daughter's journey to be in and out of treatment started. You know, she would come home and then she will drink again, and then one day I also got home, and I remember Rob's words. You know, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I was on my green uniform. I got on my knees, and I said, God, how much longer do I need to be doing this kind of work? And I remember Rob telling me, Magdalena, you need to go back to school. And I said, Ralph, remember, I can't learn. He said, no, Magdalena, you need to go back to school. So on that day, I remember that I made a decision. I made a list of all the jobs that I had, you know, dishwasher, housekeeper, maid, farm worker, all those jobs, waitress, and because my sponsor believed that I could be educated, I went back to school. And this is when my daughter was drinking, and then one day I called Ralph, and I had not seen my daughter for a while, and tradition one says that if we don't work in unity, we don't grow. And our daughter was causing problems in our relationship. You know, she will come home and say to our son, if you don't drink with me, you're not a man. So she was affecting the unity of the home. So Al-Anon also taught me that God, who created the universe, can take care of my loved one. And in Al-Anon, I learned that I can put my loved ones in the hands of God, because God has all power. And before being my child, she's God's child. So I put my daughter in the hands of God, and I asked her, and my husband and I talked, and we asked her to leave. Because Al-Anon also says that watching our loved ones slowly kill themselves in front of us is too painful. So we talked to our daughter and said, you know, Mirabella, I love you so much, but I can't watch you kill yourself in front of me. And she had to leave the house. I said, but you know, when you're ready for help, you come home, and we'll be willing to help you. So she will come home every once in a while, but this time I had not seen her for a few days, and I called Ralph, and I said, Ralph, I can't find my daughter. I haven't seen her. I want to go look for her. And Ralph said, Magdalena, and I said, I have finals today. And Ralph said, Magdalena, you go to school, and if your daughter decides to come back, she'll find an educated mother. So that's what I did. I went to school, and in 1999, I graduated with a 4-year college degree. Our daughter went to treatment. One last time, she came home, and she said, Mom, I need help. And I said, no. And I said, don't go to treatment. I said, you go to AA, get a sponsor, work the steps, and you're going to be okay. Because I trust Alcoholics Anonymous. And she looked at me. She got really close to me. And she had been drinking the night before. And she said, you know, she smelled just like my dad, the stale alcohol. And she got really close to me and she said, Mom, don't you understand I can't stop drinking? And I said, no, I can't. And so on that day, again, it was a Thanksgiving weekend, my husband and I put our loved one, you know, our daughter in the back seat of the car. We treated her like she was a baby. And we put her in the back seat of the car. We took her to treatment program in Spokane. In Spokane, at the treatment program, they took her to a Native American meeting. In the Native American meeting, they needed a coffee person. And her being in Alatin for a number of years, she knew everything about service, so she became the coffee person. And today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, she's been sober for 24 years. I'm truly grateful. You know, God is good. She got really involved with the Native American groups, and today, just before I spoke, I saw one of her friends, and it's such an honor to see her friends who helped her get sober. She got married to the guy of her dreams, who was sober, and unfortunately, and they had a baby. Unfortunately, after 2 years of marriage, he relapsed. And she said to him, you know, I love you, but I love my sobriety and my daughter more. And she walked out just like that, you know. She didn't need to take karate classes, bail him out of jail, nothing. They're so smart now. Our son, who was, who's this great kid and who attended 10 years of Alatin, said, Mom, I think I'm okay now. I think I'm normal. And so he didn't want to go to any program. I know he drinks, but again, he's in the hands of God. When he was 15 years old, he had this girlfriend. They were going to school. They broke up. They had adopted a cat. But when they broke up, my son gained custody of the cat and brought the cat home. I hate cats. And so one day I was having an Al-Anon relapse, because we get those often, don't we? And I was snooping in his room, you know. Tradition 10 says that we don't get into outside issues. His room is an outside issue. You know, this kid works, he participates in school, he never skips school. He's just a great, great kid. But I was having a bad day. I was looking for a fight. So I looked in his room and I wrote him a nasty note saying, if you don't clean your room, I'm gonna throw your cat away. You know, so he wrote me another nasty note saying, Mom, I'm cleaning my room one day at a time. You know, so I'm not all the way done yet. He put that triangle with that circle. He put AA Allen on, keep coming back, it works. And then in Spanish, P.S., leave my cat alone, you know. So when he went away to the university, I got stuck taking care of the cat, you know. But I was so smart, I introduced him to the outside world, and then he became a happy, joyous, and free cat, you know. Today, our son he's got this great job. He travels all over the world. Every Wednesday, we have dinner. Family dinner, because he wants to be around his parents. Same thing with our daughter. She remarried, has two more kids, and they're all doing good. Carlos and I have now been married for 40 years, and I am truly grateful to the program. Today, I work for the state of Washington as a parole officer. I send people to AA, and I send them to treatment. Tell them, you can't drink. If they drink, I have no problem taking them to jail, you know. Sometimes people are safer in jail, as we saw the pictures earlier. It's really sad. I continue in service. I became a delegate. And today, you know, life is good. I have a life that I never knew it existed. I have friends everywhere I go. I have a good relationship with both of my parents. 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I was in Southern California, and I spoke somewhere, and after that I went to visit my dad, and it was hard to have a conversation with him. Today, he can't hurt me. I am responsible for myself, you know. I know he's still sick. If nothing changes, nothing changes, but I have changed. I want to have the best relationship I can have with my parents because they don't have a program, I do. So I went to see my dad, and we kind of talk a little bit, and you know, he was drunk anyway, so it's hard to have a conversation with a bottle. But after I left, you know, I gave him a hug and I said, "Dad, I love you." And I was like, "Where are those voices? I mean, how did those words come out?" You know, and then he started crying. And I got in the car, and I was getting ready to leave, and then he called me over. He's like, "Mija, come over." He's like, "Thank you for forgiving me." And it's like, you know, Al-Anon says that we gotta treat everyone with courtesy and respect, including the person who's in their alcoholic fog, because sometimes they might catch us, you know. Anyways, this year, I went to see my dad because he keeps dying. You know, they say he's dying, but he hasn't died. You know, he's bleeding, you know, ulcers and everything. So I went to see him. I go, "Maybe this is the last time I saw him." And he told me he was very cold. He was very cold. So I took him an electric blanket. And I put it around him. You know, I hug him and I put the blanket around him as he was sitting down, and he stopped shaking, and it was the same, and I said, "Oh my God," like a flashback. When I came to my second Al-Anon meeting, I was so cold, and the people around me wore my blanket, and I put a blanket around my father. The love that we get here, we give back, and we just get so much more. I'm gonna finish with one little story that I usually finish. When I was a little girl, I remember going to the beach because it just felt so good, and I had belt marks, open wounds everywhere. And when you have open wounds, the salt water hurts, you know. And I remember going under the wave and thinking, "I hope there's a world on the other side. I hope I come out on another world where there's people that love one another, where they understand, where people are happy, and they just love one another." But I will come out, and it was the same thing. And today, thanks to Al-Anon and the program of the 12 steps, I feel that I have gone under the waves, and I have come out on the other side, and I have found all of you. Thank you so much for the life today. God bless you.